Can everyone hear? So here we are in the month of Elul, the last month of 5784, which this month began this week on Tuesday evening. And it reminds us that we are in the home stretch of the yearly cycle of renewal. From today, it will be 22 days until Slichot, the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah, when we stand together to ask forgiveness for all the ways that we miss the mark. And from today, it's 27 days until Rosh Hashanah, the observation of the new year, also called the day of remembering. Remembering what? The mistakes we made, or remembering what we need to be attentive to, because we're at risk for repeating these mistakes in the future, perhaps. Remembering who we are, remembering how we want to be, remembering to be compassionate to ourselves. And it's 37 days until Yom Kippur, when the gates remain open still for us to enter until the very end of Yom Kippur at the Ne'ilah service, when we stand together as the gates close. Now, the image of gates usually brings up the feeling at this time of year of both the promise and the danger of the unknown, the new year. None of us can know how the coming year will go for us, our loved ones, our community, our nation, the whole world. We do know that some of us will die and some of us will live. And the closing of the gates has come to symbolize the sealing of fate for each of us for the new year. Although the sense of our fate being sealed at any moment is something that we can question and discuss later, as I think all is decided and we have complete free will, so both end. So the four weekly Torah readings for the month of Elul all bring our attention to the task of self-reflection, of turning away from the many preoccupations that distract us from knowing the truth of our lives. So, in a book that we refer to over and over at this time of year, Rabbi Alan Liu's This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared, Rabbi Liu describes how each of these Torah readings guides us on our journey from autopilot to awareness, from automatic repetitions of what we do in daily life, from our inattentive and preoccupied state of mind to a mental state of waking up and waking up to the reality that we could die at any point. And so the only moment we can truly inhabit is this very moment. This week's parsha, Shoftim, adds another layer of meaning to the symbol of the gate. And interestingly, it's a metaphor that appears not only in Jewish contemplative practice, but in Eastern meditation teachings as well. The parsha begins, "Judges and officers you shall appoint for yourself at all your gates." As we read this or listen to Eastern meditation teachings about how we perceive the world, we come to understand the gates, Sha'arim, as a psychological metaphor for the control we need to develop over what we take in from the world and what we put out into the world. Rabbi Liu notes the Hasidic commentary, the Ittorei Torah, reads this passage as an imperative for a kind of inner mindfulness. According to the Ittorei Torah, there are seven gates or seven windows to the soul: two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, and the mouth. Everything that passes into our consciousness must enter through one of these gates. I was struck by this Hasidic commentary because of its similarity to a Vipassana and insight meditation teaching about the six sense doors, the perceptual gateways through which we perceive the world. This teaching is nicely summarized on the Spirit Rock website by someone named Sean Oakes, whose summary I'll paraphrase. As humans, we connect with the world through our senses. As we connect with the world around us, we can respond with our thoughts and behaviors in skillful or unskillful ways. The Buddhist tradition conceives of the senses differently than our usual five senses. The most common list is of six sense doors, which include the five physical senses and a cognitive sense that perceives thoughts. The eye for seeing, the ear for hearing, the nose for smelling, the tongue for tasting, the body for sensing, and the heart-mind, which in ancient cultures, including Jewish tradition, Lev is heart mind. That is for cognizing, sensing the thoughts that occur to us. In our culture today, we tend to say, "I just had a thought," as if I'm the creator, developer, producer, and owner of that thought. In Buddhist traditions, thoughts are not something I have, but something that happened that we perceive. Or at least this is my understanding of it. This may be a dumbed down version of it, but this is how I perceive it at this time. Understanding the sense doors is central to understanding the path out of suffering, because suffering arises as a result of a chain of events that begins with perception and often ends up in our wanting something we can't have, or wanting to get away from something we can't avoid. Things like aging, illness, and death, to name a few of the most famous things we like to avoid. But these are the things that the Buddha set out on his path to investigate and ended up embracing as the path out of suffering. Through investigation and embracing the things that humans try most frantically to avoid, the Buddha found peace and release from suffering. Psychologists among us, therapists among us, may say, "Of course, that's exposure therapy," and that is what it is. We practice approaching the very things we fear the most. And after sitting with them for a while, we find that our relationship to those things has changed. Perhaps we're less afraid, perhaps we're still afraid, but we can be with them. So it decreases our suffering, and that at least doesn't make us, it's not there to make us like the way things are. That's not the point. It's to help us let go of the struggle of, because I don't like it, I want it to be different from what it is. If we just let go of that struggle and can be with things as they are, recognize this is actually how they are now, then there's one layer of suffering that we've released ourselves from. So why are the sense doors such an important part of this program in insight meditation? Both the Buddhist scriptures and Hasidic commentary recognize the importance of stationing judges at these sha'arim, these gateways to consciousness. Judges who must pay attention to what enters consciousness, either through the senses or through the mind's ability to sense our thoughts and feelings that arise, either through the senses of what we perceive, eyes, ears, nose, mouth, skin, body, or the mind. Our Torah portion for this week begins with the need to appoint judges and officers who will judge fairly, will show no partiality, who will not take bribes, for bribes blind the eye of the discerning and upset the plea of the just. Famous lines you'll remember: justice, justice, you shall pursue, that you may thrive in the circumstances you are given. These guidelines, in fact, align with the Buddhist insights, which are, by the way, also consistent with what we are discovering about the neuroscience of perception. You may hear the word predictive coding, what we think we're going to see versus what's really there, and the interaction between what we think and what we perceive. But I'll leave that talk for another day. These Buddhist teachings remind us that in meditation practice, we need to pay attention to perceptions as they arise. Why? Because immediately, with the perception, arises feelings of it's pleasant, it's unpleasant, or neutral. And if the feeling is pleasant, the mind is naturally drawn into the pursuit, I want more of it. If the feeling is unpleasant, the mind gets busy figuring out, how can I avoid this? And if it's neutral, the mind spaces out and just goes off somewhere else more interesting. So you can see how the Torah prohibition against judges taking bribes is so essential. When offered a bribe, the mind perceives something that could be very pleasant, having more money, more power, and the mind would naturally start to get to work on getting more. And this chain of thoughts and behaviors would, of course, blind the mind to what is just and fair, diverting it from what's going on in this moment to what I would like and how can I get more of it. And the idea is not that that's because you're a bad person, but that's how the mind works. And that's why we need our meditation practice, because this is a meditation is a repetitive exercise in watching how the mind reacts to sensations that are pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and watching the mind plot to get more of something and to avoid something else and get bored and leave the present moment when there's nothing either juicy or distasteful. And this means sitting still while our impulses arise and pass. And with practice, we get better at saying to ourselves, oh, there goes another thought. I don't have to take that bait. I don't have to run after that pleasant feeling or run away from that unpleasant feeling or find something to distract me from the neutral feeling. And even though we develop this capacity to get better at it, it doesn't mean we'll stop saying, oh, but you know, I do have 5 more minutes to figure out how to deal with this difficult situation. We're always drawn into that. That's somehow a combination of trying to get more of the pleasant and trying to avoid the unpleasant, but it certainly drives us into active thinking over and over. Our reactivity to things that appeal to us is also addressed in this week's Torah reading. For this inventory of the judges and officers that we're supposed to appoint in the land we're about to enter is also an inventory of important self-regulating processes in our inner landscape. You may have noted that when I quoted the often repeated Torah verse, justice, justice, you shall pursue, I did change the second part of the verse. The verse is usually, it's translated as justice, justice, you shall pursue, that you may thrive and occupy the land that Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, your God, is giving you. So I'm interpreting this not as a statement about a geographical place that we are one day going to occupy or do occupy, but the circumstances that we are all given, that we are born into, the body we're given to live in, the family, the community, the traditions, basically the hand we're dealt. So I'm thinking, justice you shall pursue that you may thrive in the circumstances that you are given. So if we respond to our circumstances by setting up an inner authority, a king, and this is in the parsha, if you set up a king, an inner, and it's a king in the land, but say we think about this as a king is the kind of inner chief executive that helps us make decisions, or that makes decisions. The Torah portion warns us we have to be careful that that chief decider does not get too greedy, does not head up, get caught up in acquiring too many wives or too many horses or too much money. We're warned that our inner chief executive can be susceptible to pursuing power rather than doing its assigned job of making sure our actions and behaviors are consistent with the guidelines set out in Torah, so that the organizing principle or melech of our internal world, and this is, I'm quoting what's in the parsha, it says in the parsha that the king needs to have a copy of the Torah teaching written on a scroll right at hand. So this inner force of self-regulation. I'm saying, if we think of this inner force of self-regulation, has to be reminded over and over of these commandments, the teachings that we're being given. And in our inner landscape, there must also be a process represented by the Levitical priest. Okay, so far, this is the third thing we have to set up, either in the land that we enter or in the inner landscape. It's the judge who watches at the gate, the organizing principle, the melech, who makes decisions about what to do, and the priest. And this force does not own anything at all, isn't about being greedy, has no job other than making sure that we maintain our connection to Yod-Heh Vav-Heh through ritual practice. In other words, within us, there is some aspect of the self devoted to daily practice, to prayer or meditation, to whatever rituals embody our connection with the oneness of all life. It could be a walk in nature. But these are the rituals prescribed by Torah to keep us connected with each other and with Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. And then from time to time, something magical, wonderful, mysterious may arise in our consciousness. And how are we to know whether this is delusional? Whether we're being taken in by magic, or whether it's actually prophecy, a special capacity to perceive and articulate the intention of Yod-Heh Vav-Heh. So this is what's described as the fourth role of the prophet. We're given a guideline in Torah. You can let me know whether this is helpful or not. We're told that if the prophecy of the oracle does not come to pass, it was not spoken by the Lord. And if it does come to pass, it is. But there's no timeline here. Does it have to come true in 5 minutes, in 50 years, in the next millennium? There seems to be no clear guidelines about when to trust the inner experience of hearing the voice of God. And perhaps the guideline is simply beware. It's easy for the mind to be tricked into believing soothsayers and false prophets. And indeed, this is true. The desire to feel that something is a sure thing, a communication from forces beyond, is perhaps just as strong, if not stronger, than our desire for gold, silver, and horses or wives, depending. Again, we have to watch our reactivity and impulses and not get carried away by an inner voice that seems to be a direct message from God. So our parsha has introduced us to the psychological forces that help us regulate our impulses and respond to perceptions and sensations that enter our awareness. In our meditation practice, we spend a lot of time just watching these forces arise, exert their authority, and fade back into the inner landscape. The more familiar we can be with how we think and react, the more we can reflect on our impulses and the impact of our behavior on others, the better it will go for us in whatever circumstances we've been given.